Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which side?
He talks about lighting as being more critical to movies than anything.
I'm sure for him.
Yeah. Boy, he's a good actor. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to be kept up nights by a movie, watch American Psycho.
Oh God, I know. I've never seen it. I'm too scared.
And it's my next door neighbor. Better off watching Empire of the Sun, in which he plays the little boy.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen that one either.
You know who his stepmother was? Mm-mm. Gloria Steinem.
Really?
Yeah, I knew it. It's like, what?
Christian Bale's stepmother? That is amazing.
He told me that. He was saying something about, oh, my stepmother. She was having a terrible time with her publisher, and I said, who's your stepmother? He said, oh, that was Gloria Steinem. Well,
so funny.
It's kind of odd, yeah. Let's well, go on, because I'm going to have to travel, as you know.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess what we were just talking about is actually where I'd like to start. You know, the legal profession has changed enormously, you know, over the past 50 years, when since the time that you started practicing, notably in the size of law firms, the hours that lawyers work sort of throughout their careers. How has that been something that you've noticed sort of at a personal level and at a kind of broader level?
Fritz Kessler would say, start at the beginning. I came to practice law right out of the Army. Mm-hmm. I did not suffer fools gladly. And there were rules in my law firm, one of which was that everybody was expected to show up on Saturday morning. In those days, by the way, the Wall Street Journal was still published on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Now it's published again on Saturday.
Right.
I came in for a few weeks or so and saw that what happened was that everybody would get in about 9:30. They'd all chat and visit and fiddle around and do some minor work, and about noon they'd go to lunch at the Union League and have a drink or two, and then they'd go home and take their naps. And I decided I didn't want to do that, so I stopped coming in. One day a partner came to see me and said, we haven't seen you here on Saturday morning. I said, yeah, I'm not here. He said, well, what do you know, the firm's open. We had office hours here. I said, yeah. Have you ever tried to reach me and not been able to reach me? Or the firm's office hours are 9 to 5. I'm typically here till 7 or 8. So I think I'm doing my job. My hours are okay, aren't they? You're able to get in touch with me if you need to get in touch with me. So. That's why I don't come in. You nothing gets done here on Saturday. You know that. Looked at me, blinked. About 2 days later, they announced the office would no longer be open on Saturday.
How did you do that?
I think I was right. I think he saw that. And I wasn't exactly a shrinking violet. How has it changed? Associates were expected to work hard, and in those days working hard was 1,400 hours a year, which, yeah, I know, today we'll get you thrown out on your ear. We were expected to do pro bono work, community work of some kind or another. The atmosphere was collegial and tutorial. I've not practiced law in a long time, not since 79, but '91. But the experience the experience that I have is that when I've engaged lawyers, that it's a money mill. Mm-hmm. It's how many associates can we assigned to a matter. How many hours can they bill? Those interests are adverse to the interest of the client. The client would like for you to be able to solve the problem in 1 hour, and is perfectly willing to pay you $5,000 for that hour if you do it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was general counsel of MGM Grand, I sent out what became known as Shuttler's Letter, which was a letter to all law firms that we engaged that said, here's the deal, fellas. No associate is permitted to work on this file unless I have personally approved him or her. Two, I expect a concise but nonetheless thorough explication of what this associate will be doing in the firm and why it is necessary for the progress of the matter. I expect all of you to travel coach, because I travel coach. And I expect that you are good enough, or I wouldn't have hired you, that you will have lots of other clients, and therefore, while you are flying, will be able to work on other client matters and not bill me for your travel time. Sincerely yours. It went on and on. I mean, how much you can charge me for Xerox, how much you can, you know, the whole thing. People were just infuriated by it.
Mm-hmm.
The general counsel of Disney heard about it and copied my letter word for word and sent it back. So I think it's a much more mechanical practice. I think that's inimical to the interests of the clients. And I think there are developing tensions between clients and lawyers now that didn't used to exist.
What do you think? Where did the change happen? Why?
I think it was a sense of frustration in being able to monetize work, good legal work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you charge for it? I once got a bill from an attorney in London that I'd asked for a listing of everything he did. And I noticed that he had charged me, as he put it, $5 for thinking and shower. I was perfectly willing to pay that. Okay? I was perfectly willing to pay it. But $5 for research? I want to know why, where, and what. And I'd like to see the result. What I am suggesting to you is that clients want not just massive legal services done in complex cases. In that situation, I can see charging by the hour, because you don't know how much it's going to cost, you don't know how long it's going to go on. But ordinary legal matters, a contract, a simple merger, if there are any simple mergers left, those things can be done on the basis of fee for service. We'll do your deal. It's $50,000. If we can do it more cheaply, we'll have more money left at the end of the day to split among the partners.
Mm-hmm.
If we can do it, if we underestimate it, that's our risk. And we are experienced in doing these transactions, so we know what the risk is. You don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the client doesn't, except this client did. I once had the wonderful experience of telling Skadden Arps that they wanted to do a motion for summary judgment in a matter that I was very deeply involved in. And I said, do you think we'll win? He said, well, certainly the next step that we should take. He said, how much will it cost? I don't know. Well, how many motions for summary judgment has your firm made in the last year? What was the average cost? Well, we don't, it just takes what it takes. You understand? We just do what we have to do. And I said, do you have to do it to prevent liability for malpractice? Or do you have to do it for the benefit of the client? And there was silence. Let's see. Here's what I think. Here's what I think it should cost. They said, we won't do it for that. I said, fine, you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
And I fired.
And do you think that there was more of a conscious focus on client service when you started your career than the
Absolutely. And the associates today are so insulated from clients.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I started meeting clients second day I was in the law firm.
And you were a corporate associate.
I'm a corporate associate. And I'd be told, come on, we're going to a meeting, we're going to discuss a new product in the mutual fund industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go in, and the first thing that my partner would say was, this is Gene Shuttler, he's not on your bill. He's here to learn.
Mm-hmm.
The clients appreciated that, and so did I.
Yeah.
And now I wrote down this time I spent, but it was...
Right, the firm paid you with this client.
The firm didn't, the client didn't.
Yeah.
I think that leads to an internal tension. You feel so removed from the clients. They're nameless figures that you never meet, never talk to, don't know anything about. You don't know anything about getting clients and keeping clients, and you damn well better learn that, because someday you're going to have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard. It's a very hard system, and that's why so many people are dropping out. They don't want to do this anymore. They feel. I mean, you've got the lawyers with the what I call heavy pencils, who, you know, don't have any trouble making their hours. They just write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that happens, and you know it happens. It's obscene. It's dishonest. Lawyers shouldn't be dishonest. And that pressure to get the billable hours in, mm-hmm, induces that kind of dishonesty. And it may seem petty, but it isn't.
No, yeah.
It really isn't.
And you said that, you just said before we went back on the tape, that you blame your generation for this.
I do. I think there was a guy who went to Yale Law School, this is an example, Holton example, went to Yale Law School, who was general counsel of Gulf and Western.
Mm-hmm.
And he, which owned at that point Paramount, and he...
A contemporary of yours?
No, he was 5 or 6 years ahead of me.
Okay.
Only one of my contemporaries that I know of has gone to jail. But there is one. I'll tell you about that off the record,
okay,
too.
You know, I want to hear about it.
Yeah, it is fascinating. But this guy, I was working on a transaction with him, and he kept complaining. He said, you know, he said, Bluthorn is going to make $50 million on this deal. And what do I get? You know, what do I get? I get my salary. It's just not right. And well, turned out that he created companies that he was paying out of the legal funds for research and stuff like that. And he ended up going to jail. But the point of that story is that lawyers had a sense that they weren't getting enough of the pie. These transactions were generating huge fees,
mm-hmm,
for the investment bankers, for the banks, and the lawyers who were working on them were not generating huge fees. They were making good money, they were all living in nice houses, but they weren't living in sprawling estates.
Mm-hmm.
That envy, if I can call it that, and I think it is, led them to think, well, wait a second, I'm smart. And I ought to have a piece of this pie. How can I do that? Well, I can get my associates to work harder, and we all know the accretive effect that has on partnerships. I'll get mine that way. What they should have done was to say, this is a fee-based transaction. I'll do this for you. It'll cost you $5 million, but you'll make $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
Who wouldn't take that? So instead, they bill $8 million and I don't know, the system seems so inherently unbalanced to me.
And everybody today, you know, in law firms, everybody works more. The associates work more, but the partners
work a lot more. Dogs.
Yeah.
And again, it's this compulsion to make lots of money. God is my judge. I've always wanted to make money. But I've never been willing to do anything to make money. Mm-hmm. And I've never been willing, to cheat to make money. But what's happened today is that somehow the measuring bar, and I blame another Yale Law School graduate, Steve Brill.
Oh, really?
For starting that. I mean, he's the guy who started publishing.
Yeah, I took a class from
about
him, actually.
What lawyers were making, you know, the American lawyer. What to do about it is a very different subject from what it is.
Right.
I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there are a lot of general counsel around who believe that law firms' fees have gotten out of shape, right? I know one company here in Southern California that gets all its patent applications written, all of them, in India.
Wow. Yeah.
And they have a general counsel who's a patent lawyer, and he says the quality of work is absolutely equal to the quality that I could get from going down to Newport Beach and hiring a tech firm.
Not good for the profession.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, boy.
Yeah.
So we need, in some way, to get away from the idea of lawyers being producers of billable hours and get into the idea of lawyers providing counsel, helping people to understand what their choices are, and then providing the documentation for it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the documentation is not nearly as hard as you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And with a computer, it's got to be cheaper to turn out a three-cornered merger deal than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Got to. Just press that button and there comes the agreement, mark it up and you're done.
Yeah.
So that means fewer hours, doesn't it?
Scary.
Yeah, it is scary. it really is. And people are, smarter people than I am are concerned about it. I would not want to be a lawyer today. I would not, certainly not want to be an associate today.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say that because I love to be a lawyer.
So you were at Troy & Gould from 83 to 91, right?
Yep.
And you were a partner there.
Well, I started off as of counsel because I didn't have a client to my name.
You came in of counsel and became a partner, and you ended up leaving in 91. So you were there during most of the 80s and at the very beginning of the 90s. What sort of stage was the profession in at that point?
Well, at that point, our billed hours were becoming more and more important in evaluating people. We had a system that weighed, I say we, I did not invent this system, mm-hmm. though I would be happy to have, that gave 50% of the value of the net value of the client to the originator, 25% to the person who did the work, and 25% to the person who kept the client,
mm-hmm.
so-called binding. Grinding, finding, grinding, and binding, that was the trilogy. I'm not sure the percentages were appropriate. I think we overweighted finding clients, partly because we were a small firm and very hungry. But there was more emphasis being placed on billing hours. I could see it changing dramatically in the big law firms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, walking into Latham or any of the law firms in New York that I did work with. God, it's just awful. Row after row of, not even offices at one point, just desks.
Mm-hmm. This was in the 80s.
Yeah, just grinding a lot. And you ask, it's the old saw about the guy who's carrying bricks to put up this building. There are three of them. One says, I carry bricks for a living. And the other guy says, I'm helping to make a building. And the third says, I'm building a cathedral. Mm-hmm. And I would like somehow for associates to have the idea that they're building a cathedral, that they're really doing something that is beneficial, not just to them and not just to their law firm, Christ's sake, but to the society as a whole, and especially to the client. Getting that connection seems to me to be very badly framed right now.
Well,
we need to re-knit it.
And so, it seems like even though this change was definitely underfoot when you were practicing at Troy and Gould during those years, I mean, by all accounts, it seems like you loved working there and you had a great. You feel like it was a good time in your career.
I did, and I had. I had a year in which I billed 2,000 hours. I didn't mean to, but I had matters that I had to deal with, and I can tell you that there was relatively little travel in that batch of 2,000 hours. And that's a really hard way to make a living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I liked it. Liked what I was doing. Hated billing.
The actual sitting down there.
Yeah, sitting down there and looking at your time records and saying, oh man, did I? What? And this guy, what's this? 12 hours from what? I'm calling the associate, and how did you spend 12 hours on this? How did you do that? Mm-hmm. And the answer usually is, well, I said, well, I'm going to charge what I think is fair to the client. And you're going to get credit on your time records for what I think is fair to the client. So if you think that you can charge more hours and not do profitable work, profitable for the client, you should work for someone else in the firm. I'm just not going to do that. It was hard. People respected me, though, because I'd been general counsel and I knew what outside people were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But
what was your daily life like, even in that busy year when most of those 2,000 hours that you billed that year were in the office, right?
Yeah.
Or with client, meeting.
I would typically be in the office not later than 7, because the East Coast to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Did you go in early?
Yeah, I'd be in at 7 in the morning.
Okay.
And I don't like lunch, so I just don't. So I either go play squash at lunch or walk around the block, go back at it, and work till I reached a stopping point. Sometimes it'd be 7, sometimes it'd be 8. I'd bring my little girls in to sit at the IBM Selectric typewriters in my secretary's office.
I bet they loved it.
They loved it. They
fun to play with office things.
Fiddle around and use all the colored pens and do stuff like that and interrupt me about every 5 minutes to say, can we go have lunch now?
They love lunch. You don't love lunch.
That's okay. I would have lunch with them. So what I liked about it was the sense that I could really make a difference for clients, and I did. And the things that I remember as being most rewarding in practicing law were things where I would have the client say, "We couldn't have done this without you." That's a great feeling.
What are some examples of those?
Ever hear of Turner Construction? They're all over, certainly in construction sites, you'll see the name Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I came to represent them. And one of the guys wanted to break off and form a consulting operation. I said, "Sounds like a great idea, you can do that." I said, "Well, I've got an employment contract." I looked at it and said, "I don't see anything in this contract that revokes the 13th Amendment. So, go ahead and do it. You'll probably get sued. And we'll win." He said, "I don't want to be sued." I said, "Well, okay then, stay where you are. But if I were the other side, I'd sue you, try and frighten you back into not competing with them." He wasn't going to compete with them. He was going to monitor their bills, is what he was going to do. So we ended up forming Turner Consulting. And Turner Consulting turned out to be a wonderful place for him and the group of guys that he formed to help him became like brothers. And I was part of that. I made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make it happen, but I helped it happen.
You helped them, yeah.
And I had, I had more of those experiences than I did not. I mean, we had a company called Huntington Signal Oil, a little oil company that was very profitable. And Patrick Wayne was on the board. And I had known Patrick from some sailing, and he said, "We think we're going to be taken over. Do you want to be taken over?" He said, "No," I said, "there's this guy who's going to start a proxy fight. Can he do that?" And I said, "Yeah, you're a public company. Let's look at it." And that was the year I spent 2,000 hours. I could not find an associate who had the time. We were very busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally laid hands on this wonderful summer clerk from Yale, Carla Roberts. God, she's wonderful. I went into her office, and you know, in those days, the summer clerkships was, we take you to the Dodger game, we take you to the beach, we take you to the Hollywood Bowl, you know, it was.
Yeah, so like that in
yeah.
the summer.
Well, I said, would you like to do some real work this summer? She said, "Sure." And she became my associate. And we won 91% of that vote. And we had Gibson down on the other side. They had 9 lawyers working on it.
Wow.
It was really wonderful.
That's really satisfying.
Yeah. And the guy who ran the company was a guy named Tom Hennessy. And Tom Hennessy was a little, I'm not sure how well suited he was to run Huntington Signal, but did you ever see a movie called The Creature of the Black in the Black Lagoon?
No, but I think I know what
you know
you're talking about.
He was the creature. That was it. That was his Hollywood fame.
That's so funny.
His father, the principal at Huntington Signal.
That's really funny.
It's things like that that made a difference to me. It was getting an associate to think differently about how he or she was doing and what they were doing. It was being useful, being really useful, not just making money,
mm-hmm.
making a difference for people.
Mm-hmm.
I really love that.
Were there things that you, besides billing, that you didn't like at all?
Well, timekeeping and billing go together.
Yeah, no.
And I was awful at timekeeping, and billing. I got to be very good at timekeeping because I had to set an example. But I really didn't like it, and I didn't much like the firm politics. that inevitably come along. I was certainly a part of them, but it, I think that's just the human condition. I don't think it's special to law firms.
Right.
Honestly.
Did you feel like you, during those years, had a good sort of work and family balance?
No. Hmm. No, I don't. I felt I managed to be a good father. I was divorced for most of that time. And my pattern, no matter how hard I was working, was that on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I walked out the door and picked up my children from school and took them to my apartment, and with the housekeeper, by the way, turned up too, and took them to my apartment and spent the weekend with them and take them back to school on Monday morning.
Where did they go to school?
John Thomas Dye.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah. And
so you were able to maintain that?
I did, yeah. And my, a surprising number of people lose their children. You know, they lose that binding connection. I know, I think of three just awful examples, but I regarded my children as precious, and my relationship with them is inviolable. Mm-hmm. And the daughter I have left, I'm very close to her. I guess I talk to her 2-3 times a week, usually for about 5 minutes at a time. And we constantly exchange emails, of course. And I have Skype.
Ah.
Which let me see my grandchildren.
Grandchildren. They're in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I will put on a funny hat or put grease paint on my face in some way and come on Skype.
How old are they?
Yeah, they're 9, 7, 4.5, and almost 2. So they are certainly a character in their life. I can't say that I live close enough to them to make constant contact possible.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. When
I work at it. I go back about every 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
3 million miles on America.
Yeah, there you go.
That's butt in seat, by the way. That's not credit card miles. That's
right.
The hard way.
Yeah. But you said that it still wasn't easy to do that while you were practicing.
Yeah, it wasn't easy at all. It was hard. And I think getting a balance in your life, especially the way the profession has structured itself or been structured, become structured, is probably the hardest thing. I think the salvation for that, one of the many good things that I think is happening in the law today, is that there are more women lawyers.
Yeah,
it's your class is more than half women, isn't it?
It's probably around half. I think it might be like, 48% or something like that. But I think in law schools across the country, it's definitely more than half women.
Hooray!
Yeah.
Hooray!
Because you're saying that it forces the firms to readjust their policies for families.
Not every woman that goes to law school is going to want to have children, but many of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to take that into account. And that means you have to be more humanistic about it. I'm in favor of that.
Right, and it helps for the fathers too.
Damn right.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. So I think that's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good for the profession. And by the way, I think in many significant ways. Generalizations are terrible, prejudicial things to say, but I think in many ways, women are better lawyers than men. They are more sensitive to nuance.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I would put it.
Across the board in all different kinds? I mean, do you mean that in the sense of like working with clients or in the sense of reading documents carefully?
This is a sexist statement.
Yeah,
per se.
I know you're generalizing, and that's fine.
But what I've seen among women lawyers is that they are more in touch with what might be underlying issues in a matter. I think of mergers and acquisitions. Usually I represented a small company that was being acquired, and if I did a good job, I soon ended up representing a large company that was doing the acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the women lawyers that I worked with, not all of them, surprising percentage would say, you know, this employment contract, you don't really think that this guy that we're making rich is going to want to stay there. And I say, well, sure he is. It's his baby. Said, yeah, that's true. But the buyer has made it very clear that he doesn't want the son and the daughter on the payroll. They haven't done anything to the company for years.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to make the dad unhappy, and he's going to leave. So, don't you think we should make the non-compete stronger? Yes, I do. Yeah. I hadn't seen it that way. I'd seen it just in terms of, this guy's going to make a lot of money. Is that going to make him want to leave? No, because it's his baby. Well, he may want to leave so he can start another baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. How we've been talking about the profession of legal practice in law firms.
Mm-hmm.
You've obviously moved back and forth, and the most, you know, you were at a firm when you first started, and then you were in a bunch of in-house positions, mm-hmm. and then you were at Shore and Gould for many years, and then you went on to be general counsel at MGM Grand and to do other executive jobs at other companies.
Sure.
Do you think that the business world has undergone similar changes to the legal world, or do you think it's totally different? How has that sort of aspect of your career evolved?
I don't know the answer to the question because I've never really considered it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a...
It's different because it's not client work.
Yeah, and it's like a fish swimming. And he's swimming through the Gulf Stream. He's pretty happy. The temperature of the water is around 70. That fish swims out of the Gulf Stream. He's still swimming, but the water's colder and he dies. And he doesn't really understand why. I think the world is changing in ways that I haven't thought about. Because it's not, my idea was to keep swimming in warm water. But the business world's changed dramatically too.
Mm-hmm.
And the world economy is, and I'm now 74. I trust you'll edit that out.
We don't know what year you graduated from college or anything like that.
I'm going to use this as part of my dating service. But if you look even at the world economy now, I mean, we were in terrible trouble. I'm 74 and I've never seen a time when there was so much absolute, I won't say certainty, but great likelihood of true economic chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Germany in 1936. That is really scary.
Yeah.
And it's worldwide, because we now reluctantly find out that, guess what? We're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Partly because of the internet, partly because airplanes, partly because we are really all connected. At the end of the day, it's just one planet. You better pay attention to that.
Yeah.
But it's a great concern. How businesses have changed? I haven't. That's why I didn't answer the question. I answered a different question. Answer the question,
okay.
No, not the other question.
Hard to say. Well, in your personal experience, though, you know, when you did go to MGM Grand and then continue in other, you know, even non-legal business jobs down the road, what was your sort of personal experience of that change? What did you like about being, you know, a general counsel versus, certain, you know, working as a lawyer?
I like not having to sell my services.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like being a buyer, not a seller.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be a small unit person, which sounds silly, given the fact that I was general counsel of Continental Airlines,
mm-hmm.
general counsel of MGM Grand, which had 6,000 employees. But really, the area where I worked was no more than 5 or 10 people.
Mm-hmm. So your daily interactions were with those people.
Yeah, and it meant that I could go in, something lawyers don't do enough of, I could go into my boss's office and say, I've been thinking about this. Does this make any sense? Or, and expect an honest answer, you know? Or, you know, I know we're doing this way, and I know you've got your reasons, but I can't figure it out. I can't figure out why it's better. And you can't do that if you're practicing law. You can do it by your own firm, but you can't do it
mm-hmm.
to your client.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that part of it. I love the opportunity to build something.
Mm-hmm.
There's lawyers, my kind of lawyering was transactional. You do a deal, say goodbye to the client. If you're lucky or good, you get another client from that transaction, which happened to me all the time. But not all the time, some of the time. But I mean, we built MGM Grand. When I started with MGM Grand, there were 9 employees total. When I left, there were 6,000.
Wow.
I told everybody it's because
you had a spot at the table during that time, which is what was satisfying.
I felt like I was doing something
mm-hmm.
that made a difference to thousands of people.
And how did that building differ in your mind and in your experience from the example you gave earlier about Turner and, you know, helping people build their businesses?
Well, Turner, the satisfying part about Turner was that I helped a man I knew and liked and respected do what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make that business obscenely profitable or anything like that, but I was doing good. I was helping people. Building something is not always helping people. It creates jobs and all that counts, but it's the idea of creating something that's lasting, that is not just concrete, but will remain in people's memories. Jim Turner's gone now, and the people that he was worked with, they remember me, but they don't remember much about me, and it's okay. But MGM Grand, He's now coming on 20 years old, and now a great big company. I played a part in that as well. And I like that.
So, reflecting back on everything, what are you most proud of? What gives you the most satisfaction to think about? You can pick a few, you don't have to rank them.
I think I get the most satisfaction from my daughter. But I was proud to be a soldier, proud of the work I did there. I was proud to be recognized as a lawyer and helpful to people in that role. Proud to have built the empire that MGM Grand became. But the last real job I had was as president of Atlantic Crossing. And I think, people used to laugh at me, that Atlantic Crossing was in the peace business. I gave a speech on that subject in Geneva to a conference of telephone operators. And, you know, the Pactels of the world, or the Deutsche Telekoms of the world. In those days, we'd meet every 2 years and exchange secrets on how to beat the antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the newcomer of the year. I think when you build a subsea fiber optic cable that's that big around on the bottom of the ocean, and you lay it in such a way that it doesn't lay between two mountains so that it frays and fails and you have to go down and get it.
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, you've really done something that's marvelous from a technical point of view. But I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I am certainly no technician. But I'll tell you what I am. I'm somebody who got something done. And that's something enabled people to talk to each other. And I think the more that we talk to one another as human beings around the world, the less chance we have of what I view as chaos, nuclear war. So I think the more you can talk to somebody and the cheaper you can talk to somebody, the better off we are. I think when you know somebody, it's hard to hate them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe on that note, we should end for today. What do you think?
We should, yep.
I think I need to let you go. And then we can talk about a little more specifics tomorrow.
I would